On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I am Elizabeth Farnsworth, a council trustee and your moderator, and I'm pleased to welcome today's distinguished guest. Paul Mason is the economics editor of the BBC flagship television program Newsnight. He has described his beat as people, planet, and profit, from the shanty towns of Kenya to the boardrooms of London and New York. He was one of BBC's first bloggers, and I highly recommend his blog, by the way, and has received numerous accolades and awards for his work. He's the author of Meltdown, The End of the Age of Greed and Live Working or Die Fighting, How the Working Class Went Global. He's with us now to discuss a new work, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, The New Global Revolutions. Please join me in welcoming Paul Mason.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and thanks for inviting me here to the World Affairs Council. Okay. Ben Ali was overthrown and fled Tunisia. Mubarak was overthrown and put on trial. Gaddafi was overthrown and extrajudicially executed. Richard III was overthrown, killed, his body thrown into a river. And last year in London, Kevin Spacey put on a very interesting production of Richard III, which I think has come to New York now, where he drew on some of the experience of the Arab Spring to shape a production of that Shakespeare classic. And it reminded me that so much of the situation we are living through is old. You will find on Tahrir Square, in Syntagma Square in Greece, in the Occupy movement, all kinds of characters you could find in Shakespeare. The elderly dictator going to his doom, oblivious of what's about to happen, surrounded by courtiers, telling him how great he is, or in today's language, writing letters to the Financial Times saying, please, please, international community, save Gamal Mubarak, because he is the only representative of global capitalism we can trust. It was a British Labour leader who wrote that letter. But you'll find the characters of Shakespeare. The interesting question is, why are they all arrayed in the wrong order? Why is it that we find the garbage collectors of Cairo, the football fans, the most despised people of Egypt, talking sense and understanding the situation and having freedom of action, when the philosopher kings of the Middle East talk nonsense and lose their freedom of action? Why is that? And to answer that is to begin to answer the question I pose in the book, why is it kicking off everywhere? Kicking off is an English colloquialism which really describes what happens if you walk into the wrong pub at the wrong time wearing the wrong football scarf. Okay, it's caught a mood, that phrase, and it's what the English activists in the English Occupy movement often refer to when they are about to do something. I answer that question under three headings. One is to do with the economy and the economic model, which is in crisis. One is to do with technology and the impact of technology on the way activists act and governments and hierarchies react. The third is less tangible, and it's about the impact of those other two things on human psychology and behavior and culture. I will try and swiftly explain what I mean. In 2008, Lehman Brothers went bust. If we had simply had what the American embassy told me we were going to have at the time, which was a short blip, after which everything would return to normal, then this would not be happening. But it's not simply that we've had a prolonged downturn either. I think what we've seen is the economic cause of unrest is the failure of a model. We have had a model in the neoliberal era which has been based on high mobility of capital, as we know, high freedom of trade, high consumption-driven growth in the West, certainly in America, certainly in the Anglo-Saxon countries. The preparedness to drive growth through consumption in Main Street rather than the factories, the old way of producing to drive growth. I came from New York to Washington, D.C. on the Amtrak, and I'm afraid I tweeted, "This looks like a place where factories come to die. Where is it?" And somebody tweeted back, "Philadelphia." It was, notwithstanding the downtown Philadelphia is beautiful, but the factories, it did look a bit like a World War III had happened. So we decided that growth could happen through high consumption, high globalization, high information technology, and stagnant wages. Wages did not rise. Medium wages in the Americas is the famous example. From 1973, they go up a bit, they go down a bit, and around about 2005, they're about the same in real terms, the 50th percentile, as they were in 73. So we allowed wages to stagnate. The Japanese allowed wages to fall by about 6 or 7% over that period. In other parts of Europe, Britain, we've seen wage falls. West Germany, we've seen wage stagnation and then fall. So what bridges the gap? What was bridging the gap? Certainly towards the end of the free market era, and I believe it has ended, what was bridging the gap was credit, ever larger amounts of credit. And so you could go to the poorest area, and the only shop in the poorest area of Gary, Indiana, is a cheap credit shop. That's what you can buy, cheap credit, payday loan. We lived on this. The poor lived on credit, the middle class lived on credit, the rich lived on credit. The curve of life for the young was quite obvious, and it was this. You go to college, you get a highly skilled brain, you enter the corporate world on not great salary, but what you're going to get is this. You're going to get on an asset price inflation escalator. You will get into the property market, even only with a tiny box over a freeway, but you'll get into it, and that value of the property will rise. Meanwhile, you save a bit and you put it into stocks and shares, and the equities market always rises. And if something goes wrong later in your life, you have in Europe the welfare state, in America you have the privatized welfare state, but you have healthcare, you have savings, you have insurance. Once we decided to make countries bankrupt instead of banks bankrupt, all that reversed. Now for young people, what is on offer is that you go to college and you enter the jobs market, and instead of a rising salary and a rising asset price inflation and general well-being rising, you're offered the opposite. Many people in this generation are beginning to believe their lives will be worse than those of their parents. They will be poorer. Now, we haven't really had that since the 30s, and not all people in the 30s experienced that either. Of course, for many people, it will not be true. The curve of life still will be bumpy. It won't be uniformly up, it won't be uniformly down. But I think what has caused a level of unrest, unseen for 20 years, is the sudden intuition among a generation that their lives are going to be bad and that the promise has been broken. When I was researching the book, I'd missed it at the time, but during the 2009, there were one of the harbingers of the unrest was the student occupations in this country. There is a now, you believe it or not, quite famous globally, manifesto written by students at UC Santa Cruz, which is called Communique from an Absent Future, in which they basically say, look, we work hard, play hard to do what? Get jobs that are the same jobs we do while we're on campus, because that's all that was on offer. What did we do it for, they asked, to draw hearts on cappuccino foam. That was the level of discontent, bitterness, and disillusion that was there then. And I think what happens is that that generation can transmit quite a lot of discontent. Of course, in Europe, we also see here that the austerity has also provoked worker discontent. But the worker discontent was of a normal kind. I have experienced it before. You will have known what worker discontent is like when people come for your pensions, your wages, your healthcare plan, people go on strike. That's normal. But the abnormal, the new thing, was the way the young acted and interacted with those older workers. One of the most stunning news wires that ever dropped onto my PC at work was in late 2010, when it said French youth went to the streets in black balaclavas, overturned cars, and threw Molotov cocktails today in several cities in protest at the raising of the pension age to 62. And so that's what I'm getting at. Of course, the sheer size of the graduate and student population makes them no longer, those of you will be people in this room probably who are veterans of 68, we're in San Francisco, I hope there are some. You may have thought of yourselves as the detonator, certainly the French students did in 68, the external detonator that would set off the explosive mass of the working class. Now in Britain, 50% of all high school students go to university. Some of those universities are not that great universities, but they go to university, and they are, then when the British government came and said, you know, when we told you we weren't going to raise your fees, we've actually tripled them. The election promise of the centre party in Britain, the Liberal Party, was to not raise fees, but they tripled them. That's really what kicked it off. And we heard story after story of, you know, if 50% of all school leavers are at college and they get very, very annoyed, what happens is that the discontent goes straight into working families. It doesn't have to be sort of Rudy Dutch in 68, the external detonator. They are the internal, they're part of the explosive mass. Now, of course, it was the French historian Taine, writing about the 1789 revolution, who, I will not quote the quote, but I will summarize the quote, said something like, if you're worried about revolution, don't worry about poor people. Worry about poor lawyers. Because in the empty lawyer's waiting room, in the quiet doctor's, you know, the starving doctor, the garret of the artist, in here, he said, you have Jacobins just waiting to jump out and overthrow your government. Normally, he says, they grow up. They get incorporated into the system and it's all right. But, says Taine about 1789, why didn't they? Because in the preceding period, there'd been an intellectual revolution and the revolution in manners and behaviour in which, as he said, all the old barriers of society had broken down. Now, I think anybody who knows or has lived the 20 years of neoliberal capitalism should recognise that as a very accurate description of what has happened in the 20 years before Lehman went bust. All the old barriers broke down. It was not... It was not extreme radicals who brought in civil partnerships. In Britain, the Conservative Party is in favour of gay marriage. We have had a revolution in life, a revolution in sort of manners and technology, and at the end of it, we have poor lawyers, we have poor doctors, we have poor professionals in many of the countries we're talking about. But this time, in every starving artist garret, there is a laptop. And that brings me to the second point, the technology. I couldn't put it better than the American technology writer Clay Shirky. I have tried, but can't. Let me see if I can find it. He says, network technology and the creation of socially networked societies have made it, quotes, ridiculously easy for people to form groups, choose targets against which to swarm, as the protesters put it, take action, and act much faster than hierarchies and corporations and governments can react. He says, most of the barriers to group action have collapsed. And without those barriers, we're free to explore new ways of gathering together and getting things done. This, if you've observed any of the protests, I've been up front in them in Greece, a bit in Cairo, bits and bobs around Europe, occasionally here. That's what's happening. Now, for suddenly humanity to have the ability to take collective action in a new way, after 20 years of which the pinnacle of sociology was Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, in which the title itself tells you what it's about, the collapse of social capital, the collapse of connection between people, is a stunning outcome, I think. And it has stunned everybody that suddenly people, not just radical youth, people are going out onto the streets and protesting in numbers and ways they never did before. In large part, it is due to what networks allow. They allow you to move faster than hierarchies. They allow you to assemble and swarm against what you want to with the most minimal of agreements. Those of you who maybe were on the left of politics 20 years ago might remember trying to form agreements of, you know, let's have a meeting to agree what we are going to do together. There's none of that now. It just happens. And it happens through mechanisms that are complex and not as democratic, really, but are more to do with influence and what people call memes, that is, the spontaneous replication of ideas, the rise, it's kind of a market in ideas rather than a representative democracy. You will know, why should we not be surprised by this? I was really heartened to hear that this organisation has military people involved in it, or maybe intelligence people, because some of you might know better than I do then, this whole thing about Millennium Challenge 2002. When the US Navy had an exercise, in part in real life and in part on paper, where they a force in the Middle East was supposed to attack the US Navy. And the guy in charge of it, General Carl von Ryper, was put in charge of the opposing force. The American general, he was put in charge of being Iran, basically. And he won. He won on the first day by using asymmetric tactics. Refusing to use electronic communications, swarming in pleasure boats. And they had to restart the exercise, and he walked out. And he told Bush, you just don't understand the modern world. You're not understanding the capability of networks against hierarchies. So that was all gone through in the early part of the last decade. And now we are having a worked example of it on the streets of Egypt, on the streets of Greece, on the streets of Occupy Wall Street, on Occupy Oakland. The other thing is stunning to me, having seen the methodology of horizontalist practice. Now, that's a big mouthful. What do I mean? It's when people get together in these protests, they use a methodology of running meetings, or general assemblies, as they call them, that's very different than the old hierarchical, democratic, representative forms of organizing. They will do this to indicate assent. They will do that to indicate strong disagreement. They will stack the speakers list in favor of minorities. They will break up something rather than allow it to become permanent, hierarchical, and dominated by power structures. I observed this around the Seattle-Genoa protests 10, 12 years ago among a niche group of highly dedicated activists. The stunning thing is, when students in Britain went into their colleges and occupied, they all just do that. So the networked form of protest and information dissemination has made these forms of organization and action almost spontaneous. They feel modern, and what feels unmodern, and in fact it feels almost illegitimate, are the old forms. So the network allows you to do protest. And of course the network allows you to do something else. It allows you to go around the mechanisms of propaganda. And this was incredibly important in the Arab Spring. It's been important in Greece. The 6/7 of Facebook users joined Facebook after Lehman Brothers went bust. I think I'm reaching for the figure here. It's something like 9/10 of Arabic Facebook users have joined since the guy held up the sign saying Facebook in Tahrir Square. So we are in a rush towards a networked society. Twitter had 400 million accounts, half of which only have an egg as their picture. So they're just recipients. They're not tweeting, they're listening. 400 million accounts in October last year. It will have 500 million accounts probably by the end of next week. That's how quick Facebook has 1 billion. We're facing a rush into that world, and it allows you to leverage what you've got on the ground. Now, it's a terrible day yesterday and today for my profession because of the death of Marie Colvin and Remy Ochlig in Syria. You will know about that. It's been in the headlines. Probably just a little bit below in the headlines is Syrian Pioneer, who it was a citizen journalist in Homs and was killed as well. And actually, he had posted 200 YouTube videos. There's an account on the front page of the USA Today about what the activists then in Beirut were doing with those videos, pushing them into the mainstream media. So my job has completely changed. Any other journalist here might be able to validate that. One's job has completely changed as a result of all kinds of groups being able to do what? To audit what you're saying, to give you information you didn't have. That information in the past, you know, originally when we confronted social media as journalists, our profession were quite wary of it. Can this be true? How do we know it's going to be true? But I happened to be up late at night when the Pearl Roundabout massacre happened this time last year, 17th of Feb, and you saw people starting to tweet, they're shooting, right, it's rubber bullets. No, it's not, it's live bullets. Right, okay, here's a picture, okay? Here's another picture from somebody else completely independent. And by that time, I've got my two sources. I'm not going to go overboard on it, but if I've got two sources in real time tweeting pictures that are consistent with the story of live ammunition being used, it's certainly good enough for me to ring up my editor and say, have you seen what's going on in Pearl Square? And in fact, you, three or four of us in the mainstream media did exactly that. So it allows the protesters to leverage their knowledge into our world, which as with the rise of Al Jazeera in the Middle East has been very important. Greece doesn't have Al Jazeera. Greece has television stations that are so unpopular with the people that cameras cannot appear on the streets. Me and my crowd, my crew got mobbed 2 weeks ago when we were filming in Greece because all camera crews are persona non grata in Greek demonstrations. That's how much they hate the media. But they don't care because they just do their own media. They do their own YouTube, they tweet, they go around our structures and they go to where it needs to be. Al Jazeera, they watch. Russia Today is fated on the streets of Greece, which is a channel set up by Putin. Because it has taken a strongly anti-Greek government line and shows all the stuff, the police beatings and the tear gassing of people that the Greek media doesn't show so much of. So the network has been incredibly important. I don't think we're even there in understanding how important or where it will go or where it will all end. But this leads to the final thing, the final insight I want to try and throw onto the question of why. Why now? Why here? Why is it happening? As well as economic breakdown, as well as new forms of organisation. I think it's about a new status and capability for that building block of our society, the individual. Those of you who studied 20th century history will know what lengths human beings went to not be individuals. The things they did to themselves and others in the name of hierarchies and ideologies and causes were, you know, almost impossible to imagine now for the young who have never saw that. We're going through the opposite. If you think about what I described as the way a network acts, the way a networked protest works, if you can come together on the minimal basis of agreement, do something really powerful and then dissolve away, it makes you feel very strong as an individual. You don't, in other words, have to give up a lot of your individuality in order to sort of join a party or a united front or a campaign that's permanently there with a secretary and meetings and hierarchies. So the individual feels like they can achieve stuff. And I think this is not an illusory feeling. It was Virginia Woolf famously stated in that, what was she saying? On or around December 1910, the human individual changed. Actually, she was only having an argument with Arnold Bennett about what kind of novels should be written. And December 2010 was only the time when Picasso came to London. So maybe the claim is more important than what caused the claim. But I think if that was true in the Edwardian period, in the progressive era, as you call it, or the Belle Epoque, as the French call it, if it was true that we saw a sudden flowering of freedom narratives for the individual, and not just the high-class individual, the lower-class individual, it was probably due to the emergence of mass culture. We know the first holidays, the first access to vacations for working-class people happened in that period. We know the first mass access and public access to birth control, the Marie Stopes clinics, were set up then. In all literature, in all fiction, there is always, of the Edwardian era, there is always an emancipated young woman. And that is not an illusory character. If you look at the art, I list it in the book, you know, it is quite stunning. André Gide, his gay novels. Klimt with his lesbian orgy in the Beethoven Frieze, covered up 2 years later and never shown again until 1986. Done in 1904, I think. Picasso. This was a revolution in ideas and culture that I think did have an impact in individual behaviour. And all I'm saying is I think we are going through one now, and we don't quite know what it is, but it's making individuals behave in a different way. Now, all we've got to understand this are the works of pop psych. I won't insult them by calling them pop psychologists, but because they are real psychologists. But what I mean is people who've tried to work through observing, and we're not yet in the quantifying stage. I'll throw at you three. One is the guy who did try to quantify it, Manuel Castells, who is in fact an academic here in California, who observed this when he studied internet users in Catalonia. Quotes, the more an individual has a project of autonomy, brackets, personal, professional, socio-political, communicative, close brackets, the more she uses the internet. And in a time sequence, the more she uses the internet, the more autonomous she becomes vis-a-vis societal rules and institutions. So there's a feedback loop going on between being more networked and the way you feel about your own personal freedom and autonomy. The psychoanalyst Sherry Turkle drew from this the idea that, in fact, there were what she called parallel or decentered selves emerging. These were people who were studying online behaviour in that antediluvian age before 2000, when there was no broadband, when games were carried out by text. You know, multi-user dungeons, they were called. Or when hackers were the only people who really knew how to use computers. Now, she observes the self in this context, among these hackers and these gamers, is no longer simply playing different roles in different settings. There is a decentered self that exists in many worlds and plays many roles at the same time. The experience of this parallelism, she says, encourages treating on-screen and off-screen lives with a surprising degree of equality. I think that is a valid observation. Another one was made as a critique of that by a science writer based in LA, Margaret Wertheim, who wrote, look, no, it's not a decentered self. She thinks what we're witnessing is the birth of a new domain, a space that did not exist before, the online consciousness. If the self continues into cyberspace, she says, it becomes almost like a fluid, leaking out around us all the time and joining each of us into a vast ocean or web of relationships with other leaky selves. Of that sentence, I love the word leaky selves, because I'm 52 years old. I don't think myself is so leaky. But when I observe my friends and colleagues and my younger colleagues, what are they doing? They're sitting in one room in one relationship, and they're texting somebody else or tweeting them with another thing. And they say, maybe those of you who do that, you know, maybe your partner is the person sitting on the sofa next to you. What's so interesting about the person you're tweeting when you haven't seen me all day? Well, what's so interesting, says this generation, is it's hypersocial. There's no competition between this real world, this flesh world relationship, and the one online which I am developing. Myself is entirely capable of doing both at the same time. Now, look, these are speculative thoughts. They are self-professedly metaphysical. They are on the basis of anecdote and observation rather than yet measurable. But I think there's something in it. I think that if it's true, because I've been a labour historian, if certainly the workers who made the wobblies in this country were people who consumed cinema. They consumed early cinema, certainly phonograms. They certainly tried to, Joe Hill, all he did was take hit records where everybody knew the tune and changed the words. That was the important thing about the Joe Hill songs, that everybody knew the tune already because it was on the pianola players or on early phonograms. So there was a mass sudden uniformity of information that there hadn't been before, and a mass access to kinds of consumption that their parents thought was, quote, egoism. The entire mid-century labour movement in the 19th century had a campaign against egotism. I think the generation that made the 1900s looked egotistical to their parents. This generation looks egotistical, maybe to us. But look what they are achieving. We've seen the Arab Spring, an amazing overturn that people thought was impossible. There's whole reams of theories about it being durable, the autocracies in the Middle East being durable. China's the other one everybody thinks is durable. I don't think so. But where it goes next is very difficult to predict, because the scale of the crisis is not over. There's no new model emerging to replace this old broken one of credit and consumption. And until there is, there's a huge uncertainty. And in that uncertainty, we get events like Greece, events like, I keep saying this and it doesn't compute with people, a 43% poll rating for communists and left of communist parties in Greece compared to a combined poll rating of the equivalent GOP and Democratic Party of less than 35%. That is not a blip, it's not going away. What it leads to, we don't know. But we're in a period of austerity, leaving aside all the potential military and diplomatic stuff that might go on. That generation now has a challenge of shaping something positive, and we don't know what that positive will be. So those of you who came looking for answers and completeness, I'm afraid that it's not there. But all I've tried to do here is to offer insights into the situation as it is and step back from the pure visceral exhilarating thrill of it, as for somebody like me who is reporting it, and try and understand it. And those are the tools I use as I try and report it. Thank you.
Okay, this first question is from the audience. Please address ways that spontaneous, unfocused action can achieve focused, lasting, coherent change. And also powerful leaders can use the openness of technology against uprisings. Mm. So the first one, the unfocused action and lasting change.
I'll be told to be brief in these answers so we get the full thing in. And I will be. I'll be very, very
telegraphic. You can be a little longer telegraphic. In this one. This is tough. This is a good one.
Okay. I think only me and Glenn Beck in the mainstream media have really noticed the existence of this book, The Coming Insurrection. I am as obsessed with it as he is. He thinks it caused it all. It's a book by 9 anarchists called The Invisible Committee. But in it, what they do is explain what the answer to that question is. They're French. And they say, we're not trying to do focused outcomes like that. We're trying to, as they put it, find each other and create small poles of opposition within capitalism, to live despite it, to create a small island of civilization, as it were, within the jungle, rather than to replace one hierarchical system against another. That is the answer to the Malcolm Gladwell criticism, which says you could never have achieved the civil rights, you could have never achieved the great society reforms by networking. Their answer is, we've kind of given up on achieving through the state because we just think it always represents finance capital and we just don't think it ever delivers. Now, I doubt they are correct, but that is their answer. And as long as people are struggling in that way, you then have to be attuned to a different question to what are your demands? You know, everybody said that with Occupy, what are your demands? And they replied with this big one, this big poster, our one demand is join us. So that's the answer. I mean, we don't know. In Greece, the people who believe that are about 5,000 people. They are the ones who do lead the sort of rioting and the fighting of the police. But there are tens and hundreds of thousands of communist and leftist voters who don't believe that. And we're about to see whether or not their version of what you do about this all works either.
And well, before you get into the part about the powers that be using the openness of technology against uprisings, stay on the issue of communism for a minute. Mm. One of the most interesting points I found in your book is that the lack of the Leninist left has pretty much disappeared, and it opens up something in ways that you describe. Explain that.
Well, it hasn't that. As I say, in places like Greece, Portugal, it's there. It certainly hasn't taken the lead in what you might call these more spontaneous uprisings. Well, actually, the interesting thing is as I've gone around the UK and here discussing the book, you do get a lot of people who are self-professedly Leninist trying to say, well, no, Leninism is really a network, and it was never really a hierarchy, or not much of a hierarchy, and that's an interesting thing itself. So maybe that's morphing. But I mean, the interesting thing ideologically, of course, for these movements that are, and I think this would be also true, actually, of the students I met in Cairo, is that they have no fear anymore of being of the old Cold War problem of being tarred with the brush of being communists, the enemy, pro-Russian, whatever, because they're genuinely not in their minds. And the other thing is that if you start from the fact of some kind of a version of, I am not in the business of replacing hierarchy with hierarchy, then you're not worried about what your holistic solution is. The interesting thing, going around the USA in the last week, how many people have brought this up? The contrast between the Ron Paul right-wing holistic solution to the crisis, which is to abolish financial capitalism and go back to business cycles and real money, he's got a big scale solution, and the left doesn't have one. There's no, as far as I can see, left version of the Paul thesis, because people want to be in the business of partial solutions. I keep saying to people in the Occupy movement, you remind me of early social democracy. Those of you who've studied it will know that Eduard Bernstein, the German theorist of social democracy, said, the way is everything, the final goal, nothing. We don't care about overthrowing stuff. We want to build the movement and live our lives in a better way in the here and now. He was the right wing. He was on the right of Marxism in the late 19th century. It's a thought worth thinking that what the, certainly in Britain, where I've got the most experience of it, the Occupy movement feels quite reformist, quite limited in its demands.
And how do the powers that be use the openness of technology against uprisings?
They're trying to work it out. They are trying to work it out.
They're making pretty good progress in some ways.
Well, obviously, in Iran, in Iran, they filtered through Facebook, found the activists, killed them, jailed them, and did a lot of nasty things to them. They then ordered the Basij militia, which is the sort of reactionary base of the Ahmadinejad regime, to form a 10,000-strong Islamist blogosphere. I am guessing this didn't work because 3 weeks ago they started to switch the internet off. Because, of course, that may be in preparation for something we all hope won't happen, which is some kind of a conflict. But they have started to nationalise the Iranian internet. That's one example. Obviously, there is surveillance. So one is opened up to surveillance. And I think the activists in the movement who believe they can evade it are wrong. But it's not surveillance didn't, surveillance didn't destroy the movement of 68. What's destroyed it was its internal factionalism and the ability of the powers that be in the United States to infiltrate it, and where they didn't like it, to do sort of the classic things that repressive apparatuses do. They didn't need information networks to do that. I still think the network thing makes you more resilient. It makes you a little bit more resilient, and I think it's that. Those of you who know of Wael Ghanim, the Google executive who was one of the leaders of the April 6th movement in Egypt, his book is a really interesting source material about how networking helped them to evade for a long time. Even when they had him in the torture chamber, they didn't ask him they asked him things like, what's your Facebook password? And 3 days later, they remembered to ask him, what's your email password? They were just so stupid. And he comments about that, why didn't they realize I had an email password? And anyway, look, I'm rambling.
From what you've, these are all audience questions. From what you've witnessed, Greece, France, the U.S., do you think it possible to have an uprising revolution without acts of aggression, violence from the oppressed?
No. I mean, in Greece, look, the situation in Greece, I think, is not being covered enough. It is very dire for people, ordinary people. My report from Greece is going to be on PBS this weekend, some ungodly hour. But in it, you would see...
you can also read your blog about
Yeah, my blog covers
this.
You will see clinics set up for migrants, undocumented migrants, where there's no social security and they're just reliant on volunteer doctors, food donations and medicine donations, suddenly swamped with Greeks. And the doctors are going, what's happening? You know, the Greeks... who've fallen through their net in larger and larger numbers, being effectively being treated by Médecins Sans Frontières. That's how bad it is, and it's leading to huge levels of despair as well as anger. But I'll tell you just this observation on this country. I mean, I report this country from the outside. I come in on my journalist visa and I report it, every so often. And I did last summer, and it's in the book, drive from Oklahoma to L.A., following the route that the Jodes take in Grapes of Wrath. And there was no problem finding poverty as shocking as what the people who took those Dust Bowl pictures found. It's just shocking. The American middle class falling through the net into homeless shelters, people with perfectly... you know, drug-free, drink-free lifestyles, who've been manager of a McDonald's one week, in a motel the next week, and then out of the motel into the homeless shelter the next week. This is there in your country. And it's not a mystery when you look at how many of the poor have had contact with the criminal justice system before, of how pacified the poor are at the moment. And maybe you will get over this. Maybe the crisis has bottomed, and maybe jobs are coming back, and maybe Obama will achieve the end of this cycle without having another Watts. But you all know, I think better than I do, if there was another Watts in this country, it wouldn't be only people of colour, because there are so many people of all creeds, religions, races, who are dropping through the net. And so my answer is no. You don't. If it kicks off, it's going to be violent.
This is from a Lowell High School student who's here. In China, where social media is strictly regulated, how likely is it for a major uprising against the current regime to take place in the foreseeable future? What would be the potential sources of such an uprising?
I think unlikely. In addition to my three non-fiction books you mentioned, I have recently written a novel about China, because I could only really cover the reality of China in fiction. Because it's impossible to cover it in fact. It's impossible to find enough facts to do, I think, the kind of journalism I want to do when I'm there. In researching it, I did, you know, I've researched a lot into the Chinese microblogosphere. The Chinese youth are on there in huge numbers and discussing everything. Let me give you, I know we're on radio, so I'm trying to give you a non-profane example. Basically, they talk about everything in code, and the code for various profanities is very close to the code for various things to do with the secret police, surveillance, the government, the Communist Party. They swap it around quite cleverly on their microblogs and on their bulletin boards. So I think... The other thing is, in the space I've been covering China, places like Shenzhen, where there's been a largely dormitory workforce, it's filtered out into more tenement-type living. Still quite communal, so the bottom floor is a communal kitchen, but up above there are families and they're with children. And on the corner of every one of those tenements is an internet cafe. So even the workers, with their long hours, the Chinese working day is so long you get two meal breaks. But even the workers now, I think, spend a lot of time on the internet. There is an internet ideological kind of revolution going on in China. But, of course, the achievement of the Communist Party has been to normalize protest. So there's lots of protests, but they don't, and they get repressed. But they don't get repressed as so often as total threats to put to the social order. The strikes are often mediated. The leaders get repressed, but not so hard as they did in the old days when it was the old working class of the north of Manchuria when they really did get put away for life for going on strike. This is an achievement to make strikes more normal and less threatening to the whole system. So that it's the strike capital of the world, as you know. So it's managed to be the strike capital of the world without being the uprising capital of the world. And I think this will go on as long as they keep delivering the 9.9% growth. The moment they don't, that's the moment your high school student, your moment comes.
Could we end up with a north-south social division within each developed country, mm-hmm. as opposed to the old north-south country division?
Wow. That's very interesting. Of course, you will know that Italy is a microcosm of the European Union itself. It's hard to talk about Italian politics with any sense of dignity, but you know, their ruling coalition that Berlusconi had up until his overthrow by the European Union had in it a party, the Northern League, that banned... Do you know what a kebab shop is? Do you know what kebab shops are? Yeah? Are they called kebab shops here? Their local people banned kebab shops in one part of northern Italy on grounds of cultural purity. Yeah, and that's the same party that wants to split away the north from the south. So that's a good example, and it's a real example. Here, do you know what I'm more worried about here is the emergence of two demographics, the two nations. If you know your history, you'll know that you know the compromise between the north and the south that preceded the American Civil War, and that led to the relative stability in the 1850s. Alan Nevins, who I still think, you know, despite the age of some of his work, is the greatest historian of the Civil War, wrote that during that decade it went from being two parties to two nations, demographically different, religiously different, the economic models were different, all the migrants from Europe who were radical and liberal going to the north, the south stagnating. By this time, you had two sets of people who were capable of delivering an election result where, as we know, Lincoln didn't get a single vote in the south. Now, I worry, it's not north-south I worry about anymore in America, it's the two demographics. And in my job, I am very privileged that insofar as I can go to Tea Party gatherings and go to those parts of Midwestern America where they don't feel so happy about liberalism and report in a quite objective way, the closer you get to it, the more you worry about the creation of the demographics. And I'm not taking a side here either, because I think those folks have a lot in their lives that are driving them to be angry, frustrated, and in the way that they express it, above all with the bankers and the Wall Street bailout. But it is pretty amazing to have the hegemonic country in the world so internally riven. You probably don't realise how obvious it is to us outside.
Mm-hmm. Before we get to the last questions, this is my question. Tell us a little bit about yourself personally, that okay. you are a laborer, besides, you know, doing everything else you do, you've been able to be a labor historian,
yeah.
that you clearly care personally about all of the social justice aspects of this.
Yeah, well, I managed to get rid of a lot of my Catholic upbringing, but... One of the things they taught us was about social justice, which, as you know, is rooted in Catholic social teaching. And I think, I'm not a Catholic now, but I do think that's maybe what it's been. I have always, you know, during my wilder, more radical days, been on that wing of sort of politics that thinks it's about the people and what they want and the working people rather than a theory, and that the practice is the more important thing, and in fact the lives of people. I mean, that is what drives me to do my stuff. I'm constantly, you know, it says on my biography I go from Kenyan shanty towns to boardrooms, but I love being in Kenyan shanty towns and I hate being in boardrooms because I think the reality there is so interesting. So yeah, that's me. I mean, you know, as a journalist, you do have to put a lot of yourself into it, but at the end of the day, you're only putting yourself there to get out of people with no voice something about them. So, yeah, I'm just a Brit journalist with a penchant for going into slums. I call myself an economics editor. Handy label.
This takes us back to the beginning of your talk, I think. You say, quote, we decided we would have a highly consumptive consumption, highly consumerist, highly globalized economy. Who is the we? Who are the commanding heights of the globalized economy, and who are they now?
Well, in writing the last two books, my last one was about the Lehman crisis and its aftermath. I got to know a lot more and to respect a lot more the work of C. Wright Mills, who I think was kind of thrown aside after the early 60s, and is well worth re-looking at in terms of his understanding of political elites, and excuse me, power elites, as he calls them. I think we have a power elite in the world. We've got two, actually, who have managed to game the system so that whether it's in boom or slump, they get richer. And one of them, you know, which is the financial elite, and the other is the Chinese Communist Party, 70 million strong and getting richer. I think that, I keep saying it's quite easy to design. There are lots of solutions to this. The Ron Paul one is one. I don't discount it. It's a very coherent and long-argued one. Another one is the one that Marxists put forward. But there's also a capitalist solution, and that would be to rebalance the world so that China produces less, consumes more, its people are richer, and it's more democratic. The other is to balance the West so that we produce more, that we don't rely on credit, and our wages are higher. I think old Huey Long would have thought that was moderate, you know, in the 30s. Roosevelt went further than that. But that is a plausible mainstream solution you could do. Revolutions happen when political elites don't do what's obvious. And of course, if you were to suggest doing what I've just said, pay people more, bring some of those trackside factories in Pennsylvania back to life. I can't do that. We can't possibly think about doing that. That's against what the market dictates. And likewise in China, we couldn't possibly. We're a stagnant society. Sorry, we've been like this for 3,000 years. We don't do modernity. It's rubbish. They did modernity from the May the 4th, 1919 onwards. They had as modern an intellectual life as we had, and in fact more. So I think that this is the danger. We might well end on it. The danger is that the obvious thing, the rebalancing, doesn't happen, and then you do get my big fear is that the thing falls apart on a nation-by-nation basis. It's happening in Europe. Hungary is the place to watch, where the conservative government in Hungary has gone very anti-capitalist, very anti-globalist. There's a 24% polling rating for the fascist party. They have people in parliament with nice suits, and they're ex-consultancy, ex-accountancy people there, but they are as close to fascism as you're going to find in Europe. That's a big fear. And those of you, and I can see along the room, there are people who must have been born during or before the 30s. And I keep just saying to people, don't think the fact that we have iPhones and mass culture and Lady Gaga means that we're immune from doing it, because Berlin had that. Berlin was the most free place, and then it became the most unfree place.
We have a few minutes, so let's go on with this. You write in the book, I realized about three quarters of the way through the book that you were up to something much broader, really, than the Arab Spring and all the other revolts you talk about. And I'll just quote you on page 152, the future hangs in the balance, you write. And you're talking about the archetypes, as you see them, that might shape a new 21st century. And you ask whether they could prevail against austerity, nationalism, and religious fundamentalism. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, it picks up from where I've just said. If I'm right, and if there is a more deeply embedded individualism and a non-selfish individual, that's where the leaky self thing comes in. If I'm right, and there's something about the combination of technology and the way that we've become, you know, the way we became consumers. Suddenly you walk into a shop, you're important. If you walk into a shop in Soviet Russia, you can see the absolute opposite of what it is to be a consumer in modern in modern America. Because you walk into a shop, not just in Soviet Russia, but to be honest, in 1970s Britain, that they're important, you're not important. We became the ones who could choose. And now, in the 30s, when it did all go down that route, and it went down it again, to be quite honest, in the 60s and 70s in parts of the world, I think we were naturally hierarchical. Leftism was hierarchical, rightism was hierarchical, militaries, going back to you military guys, were hierarchical. There was command and control downwards rather than the freedom of action at a lower level. Now we're less hierarchical. And I do hope that this means, and also the other thing is, we have a load more information. I keep saying this. If you give Frodo Baggins a cell phone, the story of Lord of the Rings gets a lot shorter and ends differently. Okay, somebody heckled me, but Sauron could block the network. Okay, but look, if you give anybody in Shakespeare, Dickens, Trollope, anybody in fiction, some of these network technologies, the plot is circumvented. Maybe therefore the plot this time can be circumvented, because what was it that made people, you know, march and burn books? It was the lack of information. It was the total lack of knowledge and the monopoly of knowledge that states had. Even the Brits, or Orwell himself, you know, the critic of this system. Orwell's job with his wife was to spread rumours during World War II. Carrots are good for you. Then there's a shortage of carrots. Carrots are bad for you. You know, Orwell writes about doing this. I mean, look, you know, the carrots are good for you, carrots are bad for you. What will happen within a millisecond of that happening on the internet now would be on Twitter. You suddenly get, no, look, it says here in the Lancet, it says here in the British Medical Journal, whether it's good for you or bad for you. You said that yesterday. You can't say the opposite today. That Orwellian world, they can try, yes. But the Orwellian world is much more difficult to create with information. And it's not just the fact that we have the mercurial flow of information. The fact is we have more information. Of the 50 million, did I say in the book, scientific papers written since the Royal Society was founded in the 17th century, I think 25 million were written in the last 15 years. And increasingly one can get access to them. I know they want us to be behind a paywall and not read them, but increasingly one can get them. We have knowledge.
We have about 2 minutes, and this is the final question. You talk about all this, and then finally you have to say also that the deprived half of humanity doesn't have access to the internet.
That's true, but it is half. There's 3 billion city dwellers now, we know. There are 3 billion cell phones in existence, in use. The entire Facebook now is bigger than the internet was in 2004. You are seeing very rapid take-up. And in sub-Saharan Africa, of course, you see uneven and combined take-up. So few people have PCs, few people have internet cafes. They're there. But lots of people have cell phones, because it's been seen fit to flood the parts of sub-Saharan Africa with cell phones. And the most advanced money-changing system in the world is in Kenya, done by M-Pesa, it's called, done by cell phone. We don't have it in England. I don't think you have it here, that you can send money to and from places by cell phone. Now, when I was there, this is in the book, and I reported this long before I had the idea that technology was causing social revolutions. When you observe the impact of a cell phone on a highly stratified and almost pre-capitalist society, it's very, very obvious what it is. It breaks up social relationships. It breaks up indentured-type labour. A Maasai woman said to me, you know, it's everything's different because we have these, even though we charge them on solar. It's now not pointless to ring the hospital, even though we're miles away from the hospital. It's not pointless to ring them if somebody gets really sick. You can ring your cowherd and find out about how your cows are. But the interesting thing, she said, I said, what's the biggest change? She said, the biggest change is our husbands have worked out that there's a button on it where you press it and they find out who we've been phoning. And they say to us, who is that? Who's that? She said, that's the biggest change our lives have gone through.
That concludes our program. Please join me in thanking Paul Mason.
Thank you.
I want to thank the audience as well for this really, really terrific questions that you gave me. And I want to remind you that Mr. Mason's book, Why It's Kicking Off Everywhere, is available for sale courtesy of Books, Inc., and he will stay on stage now to sign copies. Thank you all for coming.